and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by former Vice President Joe Biden that he is entering the Democratic presidential race, and in doing so, in a 3.5-minute video, he staked out a moral stance against Trump, recalling the white supremacists at Charlottesville who murdered a young woman before our eyes, who the president praised as very fine people, as a reason to run, saying, "We are in a battle for the soul of this nation, and if Trump is reelected, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are, and I cannot stand by and watch that happen." Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment, joins us to discuss the high stakes in the crowded field of Democratic hopefuls in the presidential primaries, with a younger progressive base wanting someone they like when later in the general election an older and more centrist electorate will choose the next president. And although a recent op-ed by former Clinton White House spokesman Joe Lockhart posited that the re-election of Trump would destroy the Republican Party, the opposite may be true, with Democrats now angry at Hillary Clinton for losing to Donald Trump, giving up on their party if they lose to Trump a second time in 2020. Then we will look into reports that former Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen could not even bring up Russia's continuing meddling in our elections to her boss, the president, because Trump doesn't want to hear it. Michael Greenberger, the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he teaches courses in cybersecurity and leads a team of experts on cybersecurity law, joins us to discuss how Trump and the Republicans have sold us out to the Russians, who will help elect them in 2020 as they did in 2016, and that it is up to the states to shore up our election systems because Trump is making sure the federal government will do nothing to stop future cyber attacks. Then finally, we will speak with Moira Donegan, a writer in New York whose work has appeared in the London Review of Books and the Paris Review, about her article at The Guardian, "Enough Playing Nice, It's Time to Pack the Courts." With prominent legal analysts now predicting the Supreme Court will rule in Trump's favor to have the census not count all persons in the United States as the Constitution mandates, the pretense that the court is not stacked with political partisans will be laid bare, and the Democrats will have to take power to wrest the federal judiciary from Leonard Leo's Federalist Society. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include The Fierce Urgency of Now, The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment, and his latest book, co-authored with Kevin Kruse, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, and he's the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of the entrance of Biden into the race, Vice President Biden, the number 20, I believe he is, on the sweepstakes. Number 19, by the way, was Seth Moulton, an Iraq war vet who said he was entering the race because there was nobody talking about national security issues. Presumably, Biden would bring some of that with him. What do you think he's going to run on?
He's going to run on the fact that he thinks he's the best bet to win. It will be being winnable will be his theme. He's the best bet for Democrats to defeat President Trump. He is experienced. He can appeal to working class voters, the voters who defected in states like Wisconsin. And that will be his major claim. It won't be big ideas. It won't be an inspirational candidate. It will be more a practical choice that he will put before Democratic voters.
And do you think in this crowded field he's going to stand out?
I think it's going to be harder than he imagines. I think it's a crowded field and it's a very talented field. So I think once the primaries start, people are going to go after him, and they're also going to have some time by, you know, June and July when the debates start to really shine and show why Biden might not be the best choice for the Democratic Party. And he has many struggles he has ahead. A lot of his record in the Senate doesn't look so good. Issues like his role in the Anita Hill hearings with a lot of Democratic constituents. And he has had a lot of problems campaigning in the past. When he's run for president, it's gone poorly. So it's not inevitable that his promise will be fulfilled.
And Trump, of course, is 72. Biden is 76. And so is Bernie Sanders. So is that going to be an issue? In other words, you've got some pretty young candidates, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, being probably the youngest, I think, running. Beto's pretty young as well. There seems to me to be the Democratic voters in primaries are a lot more liberal than the voters in the general, are they not? And do you foresee that as a problem? In other words, the primary voters are going to want somebody younger, not so white, and more liberal, whereas the general election voters might want somebody more like Joe Biden.
That is going to be a challenge for him. The you know, Democratic primary field will be rough. A lot of the voters tend to be younger. They tend to be more active in the party. And so if Biden is selling himself as the center, that's a harder sell in the primaries. And you're right, in the general election, that might be attractive. That said, I think given that the opponent is President Trump, my guess is most of the Democrats, if they become the nominee, will be able to rally their voters around them. And it's not going to be a big haul to say this is better than the alternative. But it's a difficult primary field for someone who's not just old. I don't think that's the issue so much as he represents a different generation of Democratic politics, which many younger Democrats feel is out of touch with the issues that really concern them. And so that's something he's going to have to address. And I don't know if he'll address it successfully.
Well, already, of course, Trump's presidential advisor, Kellyanne Conway, is getting a dig in against Biden and Bernie Sanders, saying that the Democratic race is a race of old white male career politicians. I suppose you could say, well, they may be white, but the Republican incumbent is orange. I'm not quite sure why Trump is not in the old white category, but you can see that it's already, they, at least the Trump people, see Biden's age as a vulnerability.
Well, yes, obviously very ironic. I assume she added career politicians at the end as a way to distinguish who the president is, although he's now becoming one. So it's never stopped the Trump team to attack others for things they themselves are susceptible to. But I do think the age argument is going to be a challenge for him. It seems to be less so for Bernie Sanders, and that's in part because of the excitement that exists around his ideas and the idea that what he represents for Democratic politics is actually a fresh break from where the Biden wing of the party has been for a while. But I do think that age issue and what it reflects is going to loom large for a while.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include The Fierce Urgency of Now, The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment, and his latest book, co-authored with Kevin Kruse, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And he is the co-host of Politics and Polls podcast. So given that Biden has some credibility with blue-collar voters who got Trump over the top in those three key swing states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which, incidentally, from the Mueller report, we're learning now that Manafort, the campaign manager, was giving up-to-date polling information to the GRU operative Kilimnik in order, it would seem, for the Russians to target those three states. And Trump only won by 77,000 votes, and Russian trolls were encouraging Democrats to vote for the Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And, of course, she got more votes than Hillary Clinton lost by. So that is obviously three states that the Democrats would have to win back to stop Trump's strategy, which I imagine will be the same as he had in 2016, wouldn't it be, Julian Zelizer? He doesn't care about the popular vote, but he would be looking for a path through the Electoral College.
That's exactly right. I don't know if it'll be the same path, and so that's an assumption we shouldn't make, but it will probably be at some level. And now Biden polls well in those constituencies. Again, that is not an inevitable thing that he will continue to do well there. He might end up more like Hillary Clinton, just not resonating as the campaign goes on. And the one thing that the Democratic candidate can't do is afford to alienate or in any way depress the vote of all the other Democrats in key states of the country, because turnout was really something that Hillary Clinton struggled with in these states. So it's going to be a balancing act. I mean, the Democrats don't want to put all their eggs in this very narrow basket at the expense of other parts of the electorate. And that's where Biden is in some ways a liability.
But how is Biden going to win over this new energized Democratic base that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the kind of new face of progressive Democratic politics, a young minority woman who seems very attractive and quite fearless? And you hear rumblings amongst women voters on the Democratic side. And after all, the Democrats have always been the vote on the Democratic side has always been dominated by women. I think 60% of women in this country vote Democrat and 60% of men in this country vote Republican. So the female vote is obviously critical here. How are they going to get over, or how is Biden going to get over the Anita Hill debacle and the fact that this youthful base, I don't know whether they're hostile towards old white men, but they're certainly a little skeptical towards them.
Look, one strategy would be that he can make a practical appeal and make this argument he's the best bet to win. And many of the voters you're talking about will look at it and he hopes they make a determination that having a winning Democrat is more important than anything else, because the threat of a two-term President Trump is greater than anything that any flawed Democratic candidate brings to the table. The other is it's such a big field. You now have 20 Democratic candidates, and that they all end up in these primaries and caucuses dividing the vote, leaving a good chunk for Biden, especially if he can outflank Mayor Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. And then he can start to secure enough votes just to secure the delegate count. So part of what he's going to do is hope that all these candidates start to divide up the same constituency, leaving him with enough to move forward. Again, I don't know if it's going to work. These are very talented Democrats we're talking about, people like Senator Warren and Harris, and it will not be easy for him to do this, but that's the path for him.
Well, Senator Warren knocked it out of the ballpark at the Women's Forum in Houston, and it seems somewhat ironic that she's the one Democrat who comes up with proposals all the time, which they all seem to adopt, yet she doesn't seem to be getting the kind of star attraction that Bernie and Biden and Buttigieg and Beto are getting.
Not yet. But remember, we haven't had a caucus. We haven't even had a debate yet, and the debates are going to start in June. She's been performing very well, and I think what she's doing, at least on paper, is focusing on organizing and getting a campaign together. So she's making a bet that she could start to elevate herself in the polls. She will have an argument that's pretty powerful, too. Of all the candidates, she's the one you could imagine uniting the Biden voters and the Sanders voters more than almost any of the others. And that, combined with her intelligence and her experience in politics now, if that catches fire very quickly, you could imagine her being seen as a viable candidate by the different factions that we're talking about. So that's what she's hoping for. But at this point, Biden's entrance is going to be yet another struggle that she has to contend with, because so much attention is going to be on him.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Julian Zelizer, going forward, I know it's rather speculative, but assuming that the two front runners now, Biden and Bernie, one or the other gets the nomination, wouldn't Kamala Harris be the sort of obvious VP choice? Because Bernie's already getting some flack over being too white and not understanding the challenges of being a minority in this country. And Biden, of course, as we mentioned, is already being accused of being too old and too white.
It could be. Look, two constituencies that were important in the Obama coalition, for sure, the African-American vote and the turnout that Obama was able to obtain was really important to his victory. And so whatever the Democratic ticket is, that's going to be essential in the coming campaign. And then the women's vote will be very important. And in many ways, after everything that's happened since 2017, I think there's a lot of Democratic female voters who are expecting the party to deliver at this point and to start fulfilling some of its promises about responding to issues related to gender. But at this point, I think many of them are going to be looking to these very talented female candidates and saying, why not them? Why not Biden and Sanders as vice president or something like that, as opposed to the reverse situation?
Well, just in closing, there was an op-ed the other day in the New York Times by Joe Lockhart, who was Clinton's press secretary, suggesting that it may be won't be such a bad thing that Trump gets reelected, because another 4 years of Trump on top of the 4 years of ruination so far would completely destroy the Republican Party. Now, that doesn't take into account the collateral damage that the rest of us would receive. But to my mind, if the Democrats don't win in 2020, after what happened with Hillary Clinton, who a lot of people are angry that she couldn't beat this disaster that we've got with Trump, if Trump wins again, my sense is that the Democratic Party will be finished.
I think the Democratic Party would be in a state of serious crisis if they can't win with this election, with this president. Given the situation that's going on, I'm not sure Lockhart's right. I don't think it'll be the Republican Party feeling pretty vulnerable and disillusioned. I think it will be the Democrats. This is a campaign they should win. You don't have these approval numbers for a president that never reached 50%. You don't have these kinds of very serious problems, including the possibility of an impeachment proceeding at this point in a presidency. And then lose the election, I think the Democrats would be divided and disillusioned and searching for new kinds of answers. So I don't think the health of the party would be very good under those circumstances.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include The Fierce Urgency of Now, The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment, and his latest book, co-authored with Kevin Kruse, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, and he's the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into reports that former Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen could not even bring up Russia's continuing meddling in our elections to her boss, the president, because Trump doesn't want to hear it.
Lord, I know a secret swore I'd never tell. I know what makes old Joe hook and punch and roll like hell.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Future Trading Commission, who's currently the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches cybersecurity courses and leads a team of experts on cybersecurity law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Michael. And what did you make of the New York Times article that revealed that the outgoing Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, apparently could not bring up the issue of Russia's continuing meddling in our election processes in this country and our systems, and that they expect what they did in 2016 to be repeated in 2020 because the president, Trump, does not want to know about it. And they're sort of cowed into ignoring this clear and present danger.
Well, it is a clear and present danger. It's obviously, as you know, this is really a state responsibility. So we have, you know, 50 states trying to protect their elections, and some are not doing a very good job at it. The role of the Department of Homeland Security was trying to help states shore up their defenses. And, you know, the Obama Department of Homeland Security in October of 2016 made an effort to help states. Initially, when the call first went out, the states, I think nine of the 51 states, if you count the District of Columbia, responded to the help. Some states, like Georgia, were offended that the federal government would have a responsibility, and it turned out Georgia had some very, very serious problems in 2016 and thereafter. But getting back to the point here is, it's not just that Trump is ignoring this or doesn't want to deal with it. I think he understands that if the Russians are able to affect the outcome in 2020, that will help him. He's been a boon to Russia. He's put the United States national security, economic security at risk by being totally subservient to Russia. Now, I can't say what they have on Trump that makes him do that, but it's really irrelevant. He wants the Russians to be able to do in 2020 what they did in 2016, and sees that as wind at his back in his reelection efforts.
But are the Republicans in complicity with him, in as much as they seem to be the enablers? There's not any exhibition of patriotism amongst Mitch McConnell's Republican senators. So are they in complicity in as much as the Russians in helping Trump are also helping the Republicans?
Yes, I think that's fair to be said. If the Russians are helping Trump, that means the Republicans are going to be helped as well. And the very fact of their subservience, if Trump is doing things that enable Putin and the oligarchs in their confrontations with the West, the Republicans are not going to do anything to interfere with that. And the reason why is they're thinking a vote for Trump by the Russians is a vote for them. The other thing is, you know, Trump has the Republicans really hung up. His support is so strong in the Republican Party that any Republican who stands up to Trump runs the risk of being primaried or something else happening in the form of Trump criticizing his own Republican Party. That's what they're just not going to do anything. They're not doing anything to help get the Mueller report out, to get witnesses that will deal about the Mueller report. They're totally at Trump's beck and call because of his mastery over the Republican base.
Well, this, what you're saying, Michael Greenberger, would literally have Ronald Reagan twisting in his grave.
I mean, oh, there's
It's amazing.
You're absolutely right.
Because, the Republicans, I worked on arms control during the late 70s and 80s, and the Russians you dealt with on arms control preferred dealing with the Republicans. They didn't quite trust the Democrats.
Yeah.
And the Republican Party had established a bench of credibility in national security where for decades they were able to paint the Democrats as being soft on communism. And now
yes.
the tables have turned. It is absolutely mystifying.
It is mystifying, and you're absolutely right. The Republicans had the reputation of being tough on communist Russia. Reagan and George H.W. Bush were deemed to have won the Cold War by being very, very tough with the evil empire. And any accommodation made by any politician, but especially Democrats, would have been pilloried. And even without making the accommodation, Democrats were pilloried for being too soft on communism. The table has completely, completely turned. I would say if Republicans had a free hand and didn't feel that they were jeopardizing themselves politically by taking Trump on, they would not be favorable toward this passivity, and it's worse than passivity, it's accommodation of Trump to the Russian interests. And I'm sure in their heart of hearts, it's eating away at their souls, but it's a great political risk for rank-and-file Republican politicians to stand up to Trump. And every now and then, you know, Lindsey Graham for a while was taking the old Republican line on being tough with Putin. But he's just completely become a foil for Trump. And there's no one in the Republican Party standing up to Trump. And therefore, as you say, they are complicit in laying down before Putin. Putin is not only more powerful than ever, but I think he is more powerful and successful than any of the old Soviet leadership was when we had a real Cold War going on. I think the West has been harmed. Their elections have been harmed. Russia, through its cyber attacks, is weakening Western institutions. So this is a full-blown war we're dealing with, but we don't have our own country fighting that war for us.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, who's currently the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches courses on cybersecurity and leads a team of experts on cybersecurity law. So let's talk about what can be done here, since the Republicans are derelict in their duty and not exhibiting patriotism, but are exhibiting a craven fealty to a possible criminal and traitor who is the leader of the Republican Party. What can the Democrats do? We've got a crowded race. Joe Biden just entered the race. I guess he brings some national security creds to the race. Seth Moulton, just the 19th to enter, entered the race as a vet from four tours in Iraq, saying that he was going to bring national security issues to the race. But with a crowded field, all jockeying for positions on a debate stage, is there going to be some coherence here in terms of a message, particularly about national security?
Yeah. I think in the end there will be coherence. You're absolutely right. The crowded field, which is as crowded as has ever been the case in the modern Democratic Party, seems as if it's so diffuse that no effective message can come out. But this group is going to be weaned down. It's not going to be 19 or 20, however many there are. Even as the run-up to the primaries progress, I think many of these people are going to come up short with money and not really going to be able to run campaigns and will drop out. And, the early primaries will weed people out. And I think in the end we'll be down to maybe three, four, at most five Democrats running. By the way, I should say, I think the California primary, which is early in this cycle, usually it was in June, it's much earlier, and that's going to really separate the wheat from the chaff. And I think after the California primary is done, there'll be fewer candidates. And I think once the field gets honed down, the message of our relationship with Russia and our fealty to Russia under Trump policy will become an important Democratic message. And what it's done to the country will become important. Now, the second thing to worry about, of course, is what's going to happen in 2020 with regard to voting machines and things of that sort. And it seems like in 2018, by the way, I've done a lot of work on cyber election issues. I'm very active in several states trying to create voting systems that are defensive in terms of cyber attacks. And I think in 2018, some headway was made in that regard. There's going to be no help from the federal government. But I think certainly in California, California has made terrific strides in protecting their voting systems. And I think in general, the states are doing as good a job as they can do. And why do I think that? Because I think that the cyber attacks in the 2018 midterms were nowhere near as devastating as we found in the 2016 election. So that is a message of hope to me, that the state boards of election will be able to fend off the attacks. And then more than the attacks, it's the use of social media to send out false messaging, false flags, trying to embarrass people. I think while certainly Facebook is not blameless and some of these other big companies are not blameless, I think they are doing a better job in identifying and stopping bots who just send out messages that are directed by the Russian government and intended to stir turmoil in the United States.
Well, the president had the founder of Twitter, which is Trump's favorite means of communication. He had him in the Oval Office the other day, and he was reading the Riot Act, saying, "How come my numbers are going down?" And Dorsey, the head of Twitter, or the founder of Twitter, was saying, "Well, it's because we're cleaning up the bots and getting rid of them." And these, of course, are not humans, and they're generated by what they call zombies, and they're the favorite tool of the Russians, the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, run by Prigozhin, Putin's chef, were the people behind it, along with the GRU, Russian military intelligence, and others are doing it. The Saudis are doing it. The Iranians are doing it, and so forth. So how can you eliminate bots? I've often thought that if you could get rid of anonymity on the Internet altogether and people were forced to use their real names and stand behind what they put out there in the ether, that would be a lot healthier.
It would be healthier, but we're just never going to get to that end. And by the way, speaking of bots, there are now all these Russian bots attacking the Mueller report, which was brought to Trump's attention and he could care less about for obvious reasons. I think somebody like the head of Twitter, he had to go to the lion's den. But I think the pressures on these tech companies are such that they are going to be helpful to honest voting and honest messaging. They won't be perfect. They'll miss things. But I think the threat generally to these companies with greater regulation, and by the way, not just the United States, the European Union is having a very therapeutic effect on these companies. I think Facebook just has to pay a several billion euro penalty. The European Union, both on privacy and on antitrust issues, is doing a terrific job to make these big tech companies honest. And I think in the end, we're going to have better times rather than worse times. I don't think Trump's meeting with Twitter will have any adverse impact. He's not going to get all of his followers back, and he'll probably lose more followers. But let's not fool ourselves. It would be much healthier to the voting process and to our social interactions to have a president, a Senate, and a House of Representatives that were all acting on the same page and trying to protect the election process and free social media as much as possible from harmful messaging.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Michael Greenberger, surely one can assume that, you know, the Russians have it's a checker state. It's a security state run by Putin, a former KGB colonel, and the so-called Siloviki, the security guys that surround him, and they regulate the oligarchs who are, you know, operate as kind of cutouts for Putin. And, you know, they're the ones that have been, Deripaska and others have been involved all over the Mueller report. So you can see how Putin operates. He doesn't have his fingerprints on it, but it is a security state, and there's a fusion between organized crime and the intelligence services, and that's a pretty deadly fusion. So my assumption would be that as sophisticated as they were in 2016, they're going to be more sophisticated in 2020.
I think you're right, Ian, but I will tell you, as diffuse as our defenses are, we're not being directed by a federal government. We have to rely on the individual states. I think our defense system is better and more informed. Is it perfect or as perfect as it could be? The answer is no, but I think it may be good enough to get us through the 2020 election with minimal interference. I must say also that my sense is that however Russia tries to help Trump, and they may help Trump, they may buoy up his support, I think his support by the time 2020 rolls around will not be enough, that even if it's magnified by Russia, it will not be enough to either win the election, and I hope not enough to prevent the Democrats from taking over the Senate.
Well, Michael Greenberger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian. Always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, who's currently the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches courses on cybersecurity and leads a team of experts on cybersecurity law. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Moira Donegan about her article at The Guardian, Enough Playing Nice, It's Time to Pack the Courts.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Moira Donegan, who's a writer living in New York, whose work has appeared in N+1, the London Review of Books, Book Forum, and the Paris Review. And she has an article at The Guardian, Enough Playing Nice, It's Time to Pack the Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Moira Donegan.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems that many people that I talk to about the Supreme Court like Erwin Chemerinsky's and others who often argue before the courts, are now sort of saying pretty much, and also Dahlia Lithwick, more or less saying, you know, there are no longer any scales left on our eyes about whether or not these Supreme Court justices are political operatives in robes. And it seems that the questioning that took place on Tuesday over the issue of adding a citizenship question to the census has been a tipping point, with a lot of Supreme Court watchers suggesting that if the court sides with the Trump administration on something that is so blatantly illegal, then but is intensely political, then we just ought to forget about it. So your article struck me as being right on the mark as far as that's concerned. So what's your expectation about the ruling?
My expectation is that the court will do what the five conservative justices on the court were put there to do, which is to enact the policy preferences of the Republican Party, in this case, the Trump administration. It's interesting that you brought up the citizenship question oral arguments directly, because I think there was a moment of great hypocrisy specifically regarding John Roberts, who of all the justices on the court, or all of the conservative justices rather, is understood as being the one with the greatest respect for the institution of the Supreme Court. And Roberts seemed very willing to accept the administration's rather flimsy rationale for the citizenship question, that the data was needed in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act, even though, of course, John Roberts also voted to gut the Voting Rights Act back in, I believe, 2013. And even though the that rationale for the citizenship question by the administration has been all but admitted to be a really flimsy pretense. So I think that you can expect the court to function in more and more nakedly political ways the longer that this 5-4 conservative majority is in place.
So it's wishful thinking on the part of some who think then that Roberts is an institutionalist, and he is, of course, the Chief Justice, and that he would rule against a nakedly political ruling. It's not your expectation.
I think that if our last hope is John Roberts, then we have very little hope indeed.
I see. So, but of course, I guess in a way, though, the conversation may be moot in the sense that if you could get to the point where you can pack the court to stop the Federalists from taking over altogether, which essentially they've done, they have a majority already, and they're packing the rest of the federal bench, you got to win back political power, don't you? You've got to win the presidency in order to nominate, and you've got to win the Senate in order to confirm. So would that be the priority?
Right. This is a little bit of it's a long-term goal meant to have long-term effects for sustaining democracy, which is, you know, of course, the way that the right wing has also sort of understood the courts is really a strategic part of a long game. But you're right to point out that packing the courts wouldn't be impossible without both a Democratic presidency and a Democratic-controlled Senate. And, of course, the Senate has been constitutionally gerrymandered to favor smaller and rural states, giving them equal representation to bigger and more urban states. So the Senate is sort of constitutionally designed to be a more Republican body than it would be if it was representational. So you're right that it's a long-shot idea, but I think that the courts have been so thoroughly hijacked by the Republicans, and their power has been so thoroughly underestimated by Democratic voters for a long time, that we really have an obligation to be thinking big.
So the issue that you brought up there, the gerrymandering and the Electoral College favoring rural states, one of the most alarming statistics I read was that by the year 2040 or 2050, in that time frame, there will be 70 Republican senators and only 30 Democratic senators, because of the fact that these small rural states like Wyoming only can have two senators on very small populations, and demographic shifts in this country indicate that there are more people moving into the cities in essentially blue states, which then tend to reduce the electoral power, whereas these thinned out red states can essentially increase their electoral power. Is there a solution to that? I mean, I've heard, for example, that if you make Puerto Rico a state, you'll pick up two Democratic senators. If you make Washington, D.C. a state, you'll pick up two. I'm not sure about the, how you get to that point, but I'm basically asking you, Moira, what are the priorities here? We know that we got to stop the rightward drift of the court and the power of the Federalists to determine the future of this country for decades to come. But in terms of getting to the position where you'd be able to pack the courts, I'm sort of floundering here trying to figure out what the path forward would be.
Well, I think that we do need to be looking at D.C. And Puerto Rico statehood for purposes of political strategy and also just for the purposes of justice. You know, these people are Americans and they deserve equal federal representation as such. And I think that could, that argument could be fairly well made for other United States overseas territories as well. But, you know, I think that ultimately in the long term, what we're going to need to be looking at is not these tinkerings towards a more democratic form of government and representational form of government, but like long term, we really need to be looking toward the Constitutional Convention and constitutional amendments to try and reform our system of government so that people who are in urban areas are equally represented, and so that our government is not so structurally hostile to a progressive agenda.
And again, I'm speaking with Moira Dunnigan, who is a writer living in New York, whose work has appeared in N+1, the London Review of Books, Book Forum, and the Paris Review. And she has an article at The Guardian, Enough Playing Nice, It's Time to Pack the Courts. And in your article, you end on the note of pointing out the power of the Federalists, led by Leonard Leo, who's put five of the nine justices on the current court. And of course, Scalia, who died, was also a Federalist, but there's no left-wing equivalent. Is that something that has to be done? I know the American Constitution Society isn't a kind of left-wing equivalent, but it, you know, doesn't have the clout of the Federalists. I don't even know who funds the Federalists. Do you?
I don't. I'm sure they have ample sources of funding. The Federalist Society was a group that was formed at Yale Law School in 1982, sort of around the time that the Republican Party realized post-Roe and post the 1964 Civil Rights Act that they could really galvanize their electorate around this idea of hijacking the federal judiciary in order to sort of hollow out and stymie any progressive legislation that went through. So the Federalist Society is now a group that recruits, you know, very young, very healthy, very, very conservative young lawyers and law students and grooms them to get appointed to the bench as early in their career as possible so that they can serve out these lifetime appointments and hand down conservative opinions for years and decades to come. There is not a left-wing equivalent of this organization that has as much power and influence over judicial appointments, and there's no left-wing organization that is recruiting at such a great speed and with such success the young intellectuals of the legal world. So I think that we do need to be organizing at that level as well, recruiting young people to a left-leaning judicial philosophy and making sure that we can have an organized list of left-leaning legal minds who can be available for these positions as they become available and as we create more.
Well, it's my understanding that I don't know what percentage of a majority of judges on the federal bench, but it's apparently considerably high percentage are former prosecutors, that there aren't very many former public defenders. So to that extent, the judiciary is already imbalanced, is it not?
Absolutely. And there's some degree of evidence as well that it is much harder for women judges to be confirmed to the federal bench than it is for male judges. So there are all sorts of ideological and ideologically linked identitarian factors that are going into making the judiciary much, much more conservative than the electorate.
Well, except one of the people that was on the shortlist on both Gorsuch's shortlist and Kavanaugh's was Amy, I can't remember the rest of her name, hyphenated name. She's a rabid right wing.
I know the person you're referring to, and I cannot remember her name either. Of course,
yeah.
There are.
Yeah.
there are legions of junior Phyllis Schlafly's eager to perpetuate the conservative agenda as well.
Right. She was from Notre Dame, where she led a group of, you know, the sacred fetus worshippers. That the minute that the child is born, they don't want to know about. So let's talk a little bit then about, we are talking about the Federalists. And one of the things that came up recently, I do a forum at UCLA, and I had a bunch of people that are very familiar with the Mueller report, Malcolm Nance on MSNBC, and a former counterintelligence agent with the FBI, Asha Rangappa, who's now at Yale, and Scott Horton at Harper's and Columbia Law School. And we were talking about trying to figure out what makes Barr tick. Why is he doing what he's doing in basically intercepting the Mueller report and spinning it in Trump's favor and being such a servant of Trump? And the best answer I got was that Barr is a close friend of Leonard Leo and a very conservative Catholic like Leo, and that Barr doesn't necessarily care about Trump, but he wants him to stay in power to push through all of these reactionary judges, this vast list that not just with the Supreme Court, but also with the rest of the federal bench, which the Federalists Trump basically just rubber stamps any piece of paper that Leonard Leo puts in front of him. So has that come up on your radar, the connection between Leonard Leo and William Barr?
I've heard a little bit about Barr's Catholicism, and it would not surprise me if that theory turned out to have some truth behind it. I think that it is always staggering how many of these seemingly much more opaque legal maneuverings at the federal level actually come down to, you know, politicians' personal misogynist contempt for abortion rights. It's really staggering how much influence the anti-choice movement has.
So it seems to be that there are two, and you point this out in your article, Maura Donegan, there are sort of two threads to the ambitions of the Federalists and the right wing stacking the courts, and one of them is the abortion thread, but the other one is being pro-corporatist. And I don't understand that connection. Is there a connection? Why would people who believe in giving the rights to a fetus before you give the rights to the mother who's carrying the child be also pro-corporatist? This doesn't seem to be a theological link there.
Yeah, I mean, I have also confounded myself many times trying to create an intellectual or trace some sort of intellectual or ideological consistency from conservative positions. And the only consistent theme I can really identify is sort of a contempt for the vulnerable and a desire to keep systems and hierarchies of social power working in their existing order.
Well, they are certainly zealous and relentless at every level throughout the states and state legislatures and in the Congress. They continually throw up these new laws that chip away at Roe v. Wade. What's your sense of whether they'll reach a critical mass on the court? And we'll know for sure whether that's been their goal all along. And do you think they will achieve that goal at some point soon to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Something that is important to remember is that abortion is already de facto illegal in large swaths of the United States. There are, I believe, currently 8 states with a single clinic. I would need to fact check that. And there's a number of states that have recently passed what are called heartbeat bills, which is something of a misnomer because what they're referring to is not a heartbeat, but they are effectively bans on abortion from beginning at a period in pregnancy where most people don't yet know they're pregnant, around 6 weeks. So it is important to remember that nationwide there is no consistent right to abortion right now. The court established established the precedent that states could not impose a quote-unquote undue burden to abortion access, but they've also decided that no burden is undue. So the burdens are quite high, and they effectively have made abortion inaccessible for very very large numbers of women. I do think that, we will see a decision or a series of decisions effectively formally hollowing out Roe v. Wade and sending the question of abortion legality back to the states. I think that we will long-term see a push for a federal personhood bill. That might not happen in the next few years, but it could happen sometime in the next decade. And eventually they will be moving towards a federal ban on abortion. The good news is that medical technology and also information and communications technology has advanced considerably since the last time abortion was formally illegal. And now people who are self-managing abortions in clandestine and illegal ways don't have to resort to proverbial or literal coat hangers. They are increasingly accessing abortificant pills online.
But just in terms of the specter of the United States being turned into the handmaid's tale, you know, you've got Mike Pence there hovering in the background. If this current incumbent in the Oval Office has a kind of meltdown and is dragged out either in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket, then we have Pius Pence. So when will we be at a point, or are we at a point in this country where you will have in these red states Christian vigilantes at Greyhound bus stations checking the papers of young women having to drive hundreds and hundreds of miles to a blue state in order to get an abortion?
I think that you would be, and many people would be, shocked and appalled at the scenes that happen outside of abortion clinics every weekend. And we've already seen anti-choice agitators using information technology as a way to intimidate and harass women. So a really common tactic that they will use outside of abortion clinics is surveilling using mobile phones or GoPros or mobile internet connected cameras in order to take photographs of people entering and exiting clinics, or to take photographs of the license plates of cars depositing and picking up patients. So this kind of aggressive agitation against women's rights, particularly the use of, you know, the internet technology and mobile internet technology for those purposes, that's nothing new, and honestly, we're already there.
Well, Moira, I thank you very much for joining us, and let's hope it's not as dark a future that we're discussing.
Yes, I very much hope to be wrong.
Okay, well, I thank you for joining us, Moira Donegan.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Moira Donegan, who's a writer living in New York, whose work has appeared in N+1, the London Review of Books, Book Forum, and the Paris Review. And she has an article at The Guardian, Enough Playing Nice, It's Time to Pack the Courts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we've just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review it on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.